Run it up. Monday, our last Monday, hour number two. Only two shows left, Justin. Are you sad?
Of course.
Me too, bud. Me too. You want to make it worse?
Yeah, let's talk about the Vols.
Read my mind. So, this weekend was not a good time on Rocky Top. It is the first time in the history of Tennessee football that they have lost five consecutive games by double digits. How did they do it? Jarrett Guarantano threw a pick six to smoke Monday, and it was all downhill from there. You could literally do the freeze frame. You know that they did in movies in like the early 2000s? Like, where Guarantano is rolling in the pocket going right. You know he's about to get hit. He floats that ball up and zoom in on, push into Guarantano's face. You're probably wondering how I got here. Well, I'm about to show you.
Record scratch. Freeze frame.
Pretty much. And the next scene should be him on the bench, which pretty much is, I mean, not immediately what happened, but not too long thereafter. It's just at this point, you can't ignore the facts. And this has been, I'm sure, really pushed on the station, and rightfully so, because it's pretty obvious. But I'm just going to make the obvious point again so that I can stamp my name in the right column on the right side of history, which is simply this. I have been a strong believer in the ability of Jeremy Pruitt as a leader of men, as a program builder, throughout the early part of this year especially. But since he was hired, I've kind of liked the direction the program was trending with how they were recruiting, how they were starting to build themselves. The only thing holding Tennessee back right now is what's holding back a lot of the best programs in college football. They don't have the right quarterback. And maybe there's not anything better on roster, but there probably is. And the fact that they continue to go to the well with Jarrett Guarantano when it is so badly playing out week after week. They always say that, you know, two in a row, that might be a fluke. Three is a pattern. Four is a trend. And Tennessee is trending in the wrong direction. The only way to fix that is to make a change at quarterback. And now that that's been clearly explained, as if it didn't already exist, it's just a fact that everybody listening to this program knows. The bottom line is that although I do not believe that even if Tennessee did not win another football game the rest of the year because of the circumstances of the season, I do not believe that Jeremy Pruitt should be let go, even if they lose to Vanderbilt. But the fact of the matter is that they shouldn't be losing these games, and the fact that they continue to roll Guarantano out onto the field despite all conventional wisdom saying that that is a wrong decision tells me that there is a fundamental breakdown in how Jeremy Pruitt is able to process a situation and make the right decision, and that is not fixable. And if he puts Guarantano back out for Tennessee's next game, it's not against Vanderbilt, that game's been postponed, I don't know when Tennessee will play again, he should not be allowed to coach the game following that. And that's it.
Yeah.
I'm tracing back to the start point of this, the starting line of his tenure at Tennessee, and it's hard not to, seeing what we're seeing now, realize that although there's a lot of information that suggests that maybe Philip Fulmer was plotting from behind the scenes the entire time, that this coaching search had to be triaged because they were in, what, week 6-8 of a coaching search in which they had had and lost their guy about three times. Whether it was Braum or Shiano.
Someone's guy.
Well, somebody's guy. And then that guy got removed because people were not happy with the guy they had picked. And that's totally fair. But now we're at a point where if you go back in time, Tennessee had to get somebody because the wound was festering and it was going to be crippling for the program long term if it continued.
I mean, whenever Pruitt got hired, your two best candidates that were still on the board were pretty much Pruitt.
Yeah.
And then maybe Kevin Steele down at Auburn and a couple other guys, but like at that point
it was barren.
You might as well take a chance on the young guy.
And they did, and it looked like it might be going the right way for a second, and it doesn't now, and it doesn't mean it can't be salvaged. They may put Harrison Bailey out there and he may tear it up down the stretch. The season's lost. They're already going to be coming in below expectations.
Yeah.
Pretty massively. Almost catastrophically. Maybe they turn... If they beat Florida, all is forgiven. I don't know if that's true, because it may be even more infuriating if they go out there with Harrison Bailey and beat Florida, and then you realize, man, this could have been a special year, but they stuck with Guarantano for far too long.
I mean, if they beat Florida, then Pruitt's not getting fired. That much
that's
is true.
That's true. That's a fact.
But as far as from a fan base perspective, if you go out and play Harrison Bailey and beat Florida, that just really annoys you more than anything. I mean, obviously you're happy because you'd be beating what's probably a top 10, maybe a top 5 Florida team at the time.
You'd knock them out of the playoff.
But that would be awfully frustrating.
Yeah.
Not that I don't hope it doesn't happen.
There is no more frustrating or saddening question in sports or just life generally than asking what could have been. But aside from that, I think when you look back at it with Pruitt, Tennessee is not particularly beholden to him long term, because they kind of were forced into a corner when they had to hire him. So maybe you just want to see what an actual coaching search with Philip Fulmer might look like. And I mean, there are candidates out there. Again, I've been banging my chest that somebody should go out and get Joe Brady. I don't know how many people would want the Tennessee job right now. Pretty radioactive. They can throw a lot of money at the problem that doesn't seem to fix it.
I mean, I don't think Joe Brady's coming back to Tennessee. If he's going to come back for a college job, I don't foresee it being the situation that the
program's
in right now.
Probably not, but I would throw a lot of money at him. He would be my first call. And then I'd get head coaches around him. Good assistants. But that's besides the point. Maybe it's Hugh Freeze, who's had success in the SEC, but has been courting the South Carolina job, and they've been courting him. Maybe it's Napier down at Louisiana, but I mean, we've never seen Tennessee hire a guy out of the P5 and it be successful. Maybe they're going about it the wrong way. Maybe that's what they need to do. But usually you don't see guys skip the rock on the pond and jump an extra hop or two to a place like Tennessee from a place like the Raging Cajun School of Louisiana. That just doesn't happen. So there aren't a lot of options.
Dooley did. He came from La Tech.
That's a good point. For whatever reason in my head, I'm like, he came from Missouri. No, he went to Missouri.
We went to the Cowboys, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but his next call... Digressing.
Anyway.
So I don't know what Tennessee would do next. It would be interesting to see what a Philip Fulmer coaching search would look like, but I don't think we need to get there unless this is a critical maxim here. It's an interminable one way or the other. If he puts Guarantano back out on the field to start their next game, he needs to be fired. If he does not, he deserves to coach out the rest of the year. That's my stance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the most frustrating thing, is that it's pretty evident to apparently everyone but the people that sit within the football complex, for some reason, that the easiest way to guarantee that all of you have jobs next year, or at least most of you at the bare minimum, right, is A, roll Harrison Bailey or at least someone else that doesn't wear number 2 out there for the rest of the season,
mm-hmm,
and see what you have, figure it out, and B, beat Vandy if you play them.
Yeah, and by the way,
you do those two things, you keep your job easily.
Vandy's surging, and that doesn't look like as easy of a win as it looked like a couple weeks ago. Vandy's played 3 consecutive competitive games against Mississippi State, Kentucky, and most recently Florida, in which they had the lead deep in the first half. Florida made too many plays for them late, but Vandy was competitive to the death and was within 2 scores for 50 minutes of that game, 45 minutes of that game. So that's not a... If Tennessee doesn't play well, they will lose against Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at. And something's got to change, and it's very clearly the quarterback, and that's it. That's it. I don't think we need to belabor the point anymore, so I'm going to send us to break unless you got something.
I was just going to say, and by the way, just doing those two things, that gets you out of this season, but you better... 2021 better look pretty.
Yeah. There's no leeway.
You got to go 8-4, 9-3 probably.
maybe even 10-2 if it's
against I don't think a 6-6 season
saves you. I think at 8-4 if they don't get one of the big three, I think he still may be gone at this trajectory, unless they put in a quarterback that really makes a difference. It's the futility of it that is so frustrating.
I mean, at that point, you've pretty well plateaued if you're in year four and you're in the same place that you were basically when you started, if not worse.
There's just no realm of possibility in which this gets any better with Jared Guarantano, and that's the frustrating part, is because the futility of it is so clear. It is not sensical. It's not rational, and it's inexplicable. It does not make sense. And if there was a reasonable explanation that Jeremy Pruitt could give, I would listen to it. The fact that that doesn't exist makes sense. He can't say those things because that destabilizes his locker room and it's not going to do anything good. But from a fan's perspective, which I am also not, but I have to imagine that that's the only thing that could explain this to you, because there's no way to justify it in my head. So I would love to hear the inner workings and musings of Jeremy Pruitt's bald cranium, because I can't explain it. So I'm going to be done trying to for the time being. Run It Up. We'll come back here in a moment. This is WKGN Fox Sports Knoxville Fan Run Radio.
How would that impact the way you looked at Northwestern as it pertains to a shot at a playoff spot?
I've been watching Northwestern play, and honestly, I mean, they got a bunch of Reese Davises out there running around.
A bunch of Reese Davises running around.
Yeah, we are a bunch of Reese Davises.
I hope they don't cut that.
Morning, Reese. Coach Reese.
Oh, my God. Reese Davis with the catch.
My name is Riley Reese Davis.
Not bad for a bunch of Reese Davises.
All I see is a bunch of Reese Davis. Head coach Reese Davis. Woo!
That's Reese Davis 1, Reese Davis 2.
Problem three. Is, too, which hate, what I hate is Reese Davis is a great guy.
Yeah.
Nice catch, Reese. Way to go. Because I'm looking at a bunch of bad Reese Davis.
Well, that was a video that was posted by Northwestern's football Twitter account. If you don't know the backstory, in the preliminary college football playoff rankings show that ESPN did last week ahead of the first rankings this week that will come out tomorrow, Reese Davis posed that question to Joey Galloway, who said that Northwestern effectively is not a real football team. They're just a bunch of Reese Davises running around, and they're going to lose to Wisconsin, so they don't have any chance of making the playoff. Well, they were wrong. At least Joey Galloway was, and Northwestern ran with it. The Reese Davis thing is awesome, and Northwestern is part of the big storylines that came out of the rest of college football this week, other than the doldrum that is Tennessee. How about that performance? I don't know if you saw any of it. I doubt you did, Justin, but what a job by Pat Fitzgerald.
Saw a very limited amount.
This team was bad last year, which is uncharacteristic for Northwestern. They've been a pretty good program over the last couple of years, but this team went 3-9 a season ago. Well, they're 5-0 now. They've got an outside chance at the playoff. They beat a Wisconsin team that I thought was a lot better than them and exposed some flaws in the way Wisconsin plays football that I just don't think you can play that way anymore and compete for anything of substance in 2020. I just think that that era's gone. But with that said, Northwestern physically took it to a team that I thought was going to overwhelm them. That was really cool. And for them to embrace that underdog mentality, to say, yeah, we are a bunch of Reese Davises, and we just beat Wisconsin. They just gave themselves a chance to go to the college football playoff. All they have to do now is win out and beat Ohio State. Easier said than done. We'll see if they can. We very well may see in the Big 12, Oklahoma play Texas for the title. That's kind of crazy. I think we wrote both these teams off when they won no games, it felt like, early on in the start of their schedule. Oklahoma lost two in a row. Texas lost two from three. We thought it was over. The conference was out of the college football playoff. We're going to get Iowa State and Kansas State in the league championship game. Nope, we're just going to get Oklahoma and Texas again. Texas with a win over Iowa State this week. I believe the game's on Friday night. Will put themselves in the conference title game, and Oklahoma would be on the other side of it.
I mean, I think it just speaks to the overall, like, I don't want to say lack of quality within the Big 12, but there's just not, like, a team from the conference, right? I mean, you don't
not
see.
Not this year.
Yeah.
Oklahoma will be that next year.
Yeah.
Team's actually got a little bit of defense to them now. A lot of guys coming back. Spencer Rattler's turned a corner. I mean, Oklahoma's going to be fierce next year. But it's just incredible to me that we're here when everybody's been given every possible opportunity to make it not Oklahoma and Texas this year, and it's just not going to happen. I mean, maybe I'm jumping the gun. Iowa State's pretty good. I've really enjoyed watching them play. Maybe they get Texas this week. I think I probably would pick Iowa State. But this is very real, and that's insane. Let's look at Indiana and Ohio State. Did you watch any of this one?
A little bit of the beginning. I didn't realize that Indiana ended up coming back in this game and making it very competitive.
Oh, yeah. Down 21. Got the ball twice, actually, down 7 with a chance to tie the game in Columbus. The line that I used for it is Indiana earned the respect of the nation. Ohio State got the win. And I think that's pretty true. Tom Allen, Tennessee's never going to get Tom Allen away from Indiana because Indiana Red is running through that man's veins. But what a culture builder. What a job he's done. Developing guys up from the studs. Getting 3- and 2-star dudes in and just developing them as players into what they've become now is really impressive. Ty Freifogel, that guy's going to play himself into the first round. Mark my words. Back-to-back games with over 200 yards and 3 touchdowns. He did all this to Sean Wade, who's going to be a first-round potentially draft pick as a corner for Ohio State. It was remarkable. Michael Penix nearly threw for 500 yards. He may have actually got there. I think he was at 498 when the game ended. Indiana's for real. Ohio State struggled. They finally got tested. They found a way to win. But it was not pretty for them. And it leaves you asking some questions about, this is a scenario I outlined where if Ohio State struggles in this game, it might be a little bit tougher for them to make a college football playoff argument. And I do know for a fact that Justin Fields has played himself out of the Heisman race now. Did not look sharp in this game. They even took the ball out of his hands a little bit at the end. Threw 3 picks. He threw 3 interceptions all of last year. That incompletion stat, that's well gone. Doubled his incompletion total. He was fine. He just wasn't Justin Fields and allowed Indiana to hang around. And I just don't think with at the level other guys are playing at around the country and with the dearth of games that Ohio State's going to play, that he's got a chance to get back into the Heisman race. I think it's over for him.
Yeah, I mean, there's just too many good candidates.
Yeah, and Trask isn't slowing down.
Yeah.
Mac Jones is not slowing down. They scored 63 points on an SEC opponent this week.
And with only playing, what, 7 games?
Yeah, I just don't think there's a world where it happens.
You can't have an off one and then bounce back. You can't afford to have that off week, especially whenever guys are playing more games than you.
Especially against the best team you're going to play all year.
Yeah, or balling. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can make a really real argument for why Ohio State, who I think should be the best team in the country, should not make the playoff if they went out over a one-loss Florida that just beat Alabama, which would probably be the case, especially if Clemson beats Notre Dame in the rematch. Then that gets really hairy because I don't know how you keep Notre Dame out with them having had the best or second-best win in the country. That's a tough sell. That's a really tough sell. We should be having 8 this year. But it's that simple. It is that simple. Carson Brebber is going to help us switch gears on the other side of a break. We're going to go through a full recap of everything that's happened in NBA free agency, and there is a lot. That's why we're bringing in Carson the Specialist to handle it. This is Run It Up, WKGM Fox Sports Knoxville Fan Run Radio. Run It Up, we are in the back 30. We've got Carson Brebber with us. We're going to change pace a little bit. We've been talking about football exclusively. We're going to take some time to unpack whatever just happened in the NBA this past week. It was pure chaos. We haven't seen a superstar move yet, but we've seen a lot of important ones. But before we dig into all of it, Carson, how are you doing, my man?
I'm fantastic, Peyton. Thank you for having me back.
Of course, it is the last week of the show. It was only fitting to get you on here at least one more time. Carson, let's start. I'm going to let you drive here to start this off. Where is your highest point of intrigue exiting this first week of the offseason in the NBA, really?
I'll be honest. I think that the Clippers have done the most interesting stuff up to this point. I think that they have arguably improved more than anybody else. Now, I love what their competitors in L.A. did with the Dennis Schroeder signing. Didn't love what they did as much with the Montrezl Harrell signing, although I do think that at that value, it's still a win. But proportionally, I think that the Clippers picking up Serge Ibaka on the same contract using their MLE is a huge win. That is a guy who is much more complementary to the surrounding talent. It's just a better winning big in the modern NBA, more versatile, can space the floor, a higher-level defensive player, not a liability as a rim protector. And we haven't seen him in that role primarily in the past couple seasons as a defensive center. If he can do that at a high level in L.A., I think that you're looking at a real game-changing, potentially championship-altering signing there. And I also love, almost as much, the Luke Kennard pickup, which they got in the three-team trade, of course, with the Nets and the Pistons. I thought that that was a huge win for them because he can give you so much of what Lou Will does as a creator off the bench, as a pick-and-roll ball handler, and at the same time, he's one of the best pure shooters off the catch in basketball, a 42% catch-and-shoot guy from deep this season. So you can play him off the ball in closing lineups. He'll be an assassin there. And he's not as much of a defensive liability as Lou, although he is a negative wingspan boy, and there are only a few of those guys in the NBA. But he's better than Lou still. So I honestly wouldn't be surprised if we see Lou out the door at some point. Now, I don't know if it's overwhelmingly likely. I do think it makes sense, though, because Kennard can do the same sixth-man thing and close. So the Clippers are a team who I was highly critical of throughout this entire past season, but they're shifting into gear right now, and I think that they just got a lot better.
So how do you anticipate their best kind of strategic approach to things? Because with Ibaka, Paul George, and now Kawhi, they can go small. They can play Mook Morris as a smaller four or maybe even play Kawhi there. They still don't really have a true and true point guard. I don't know if they'll be getting one of those. I don't think they will. This offseason, how do you anticipate this team kind of looking coming into next year?
Well, I think that we see a lot of Ibaka at the five because, obviously, they had Zubac starting in that place just because he was really the only true center on their roster who was playable in any way. And I think that Ibaka can do a lot of that at a high level. Now, we didn't see Raptors lineups where he played at the five fare particularly well last season. I think that some of their worst lineups came with him at the five, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be an issue as much in L.A. And you talk about the Morris fit. Morris at the four was incredibly effective for them this past season. The Kawhi, PG, Morris minutes as far as on-off splits were absolutely ridiculous. So I think there's a reason that they paid him and retained him, although it was a pretty high price, in my opinion, with the 4 years, $64 million. But I think we see Ibaka at the five. I don't really see much of an alternative. You're obviously not paying Zubats in big minutes over him. Your closing lineup is going to be pretty small. But Ibaka is not going to get punished, obviously, in the same way by a Jokic or an Anthony Davis. Is he still elite there? Mm-hmm. Probably not, but he should be good. Certainly an improvement from what they had this past year.
Well, even if it's just the three-point shooting that he gives them that Zubac doesn't, they're going to be able to space the floor a lot more for Kawhi to do that thing that he likes to do, getting people into the block and not getting double teams there. And if you do double, we're just going to kick it for an open three, so live with that. Mm-hmm. This team is going to be determined by what Paul George shows up this year. I've always thought that. I didn't care what they did this offseason, but they certainly have kind of foolproofed their starting group at least a little bit more. Are you worried at all about the depth that they may be lacking? I mean, Kennard adds that for sure, but now without Harrell, Lou Williams is getting a little bit older. They've kind of moved on from some guys. Are you concerned at all there?
Not particularly, because I don't think that depth has ever been their issue. Most of the core that now makes up their depth was a team that was competitive in the playoffs 2 years ago. Now, obviously, Trez is out of the picture there at this point, and a guy like Tobias Harris is no longer around with this team. But I certainly think they have a number of quality guys, and they did lose Mo Harkless, which is obviously not insignificant. They lost a guy like Jamichael Green, which is not insignificant.
Right.
But I do think for the most part they have guys who can fill out quality minutes here. They also lost Landry Shamet, which is not insignificant.
Right.
But I do think a fully healthy season with this team, with Marcus Morris, with Pat Bev, you're right. I understand where the concern comes from. My thing is I think they have seven really good guys, and at the end of the day that's pretty much all you need, barring injury. Now, they are more susceptible to taking a bigger hit if somebody does go down with an injury, and that is something that's worth noting. But I think that really, it's like you said, they're going to go with Paul George, and that is going to be the single most important determinant of this team's success. But I think that they did a very good job of putting themselves in a better position regardless, and I don't think that their eighth man should be their primary concern necessarily.
I'm going to ask you this, and it's a tough question, but how far into the season do the Clippers upper management let it go if it's not working before they trade Paul George? Because that's the natural pivot that they have to make if it's not working in year two to try and change something.
I think they do that at the point when Kawhi Leonard tells them it's okay to do
okay.
it. Because Paul George was a huge reason that he went to L.A. I think that he is a huge reason that he is staying in L.A. And despite all of the many flaws that we saw exposed this past season, I do believe that there is a faith from Kawhi in PG because, again, that's the reason he went there. So I really don't think that's going to happen. We can all look at it and say it's the practical move. You have to upgrade there. At the same time, PG does have a real ceiling that he did not tap into almost at all this past season by just playing really tentative, living behind the three-point line, and maybe you can point to, you know, a little bit of a lag from the injuries that he had experienced as being a factor there. But I also think part of it was just complacency and thinking, oh, we're so good, we're just going to coast here. And that obviously wasn't the case. So I do expect to see a better Paul George this season, and that is a big deal. But even if we don't, I really don't think he's going to get moved.
So let's now take a look across town at the Lakers. I have to think that you would favor the Los Angeles Lakers, the reigning champions, over the Clippers at this point, but I'm going to let you answer the question because that's why you're on the show.
I would, but I do think that the Clippers really closed the gap with the Ibaka signing.
Really?
I love
okay.
that move. And Kennard, I thought, was also a guy who was underrated considering what they had to give up. I thought
Fair.
That deal was kind of a win-win-win, but they probably came out best, in my opinion. But I do still take the Lakers here. I think the reason that it's closer for me as far as the Clippers actually closing the gap is because I'm not nearly as high on the Montrezl Harrell signing. I don't think he closes for you. I think he can be 18 to 20 minutes a game, a dynamic offensive weapon, as a four alongside Anthony Davis, which is what he'll have to be. I think he can guard fours. AD is playing with another non-floor spacer, which isn't ideal, but he did do it at a high level for much of this season, playing with JaVale and Dwight, so it's not the be-all, end-all there. For a team, though, that is a little bit deprived of shooting and has such a dynamic big man and a guy in LeBron who just loves to get into the paint as much as he possibly can, I would like to have three floor spaces around them at all times. It doesn't seem like that's the reality of what they're going to do. But to me, the Dennis Schroeder pickup is right up there for the best of this offseason. That dude is downright special. He should have been sixth man of the year, and that is not a retrospect changing my opinion because of what Trez did in the playoffs. I said that at the moment. I actually didn't think it was very close because he's just so clearly a more dynamic, cohesive player when it comes to winning. You can put him off the ball. He's a much improved shooter off the catch, was over 38% from deep this year, over 40% off the catch, I believe, and can run that second unit at a high level,
right,
facilitate out of the pick and roll, play quality defense. So I love that. I know that they lost some valuable guys in Dwight, in JaVale, which is not something that should be dismissed. At the same time, did they really need defensive centers, Peyton? Probably not, because they have the best defensive center in the league, maybe.
Well,
he just didn't want to play at that position.
Well, they did get a defensive center, and that's the guy that I think you're overlooking
True.
A little bit in this explanation, and why. At first, I was like, okay, the Lakers are going to be a way different basketball team next year. They were defensively oriented this past year. It served them well, but it's what they had to be because their personnel was aged out in a lot of ways, and they just weren't going to get that kind of dominant offense. They were just going to have to try harder than everybody else. This year, they added Schroeder, which is going to be a massive upgrade offensively, and when he's locked in, he's pretty decent defensively as well. You added Montrez, who is, for all intents and purposes, he's a guy who tries really hard defensively, but is not going to massively impact the game defensively. He's a plus on offense. But you added Marc Gasol, and that's why I think they're so much better than the Clippers coming in the next year, is because last year my biggest question with them was They had the two top five guys, and that's usually enough. It was enough. They overpowered everybody. They won a title. I didn't trust everything else around them. Now they're top eight guys. I don't love Kyle Kuzma being your third or fourth best player. Him as your eighth best dude, your seventh best dude, that team is going to be better than they were last year. I think they're the best team in the league by a lot. And with Gasol, I just think that when you're talking about a team that goes LeBron, and I don't want to just write down a list of names here, but you kind of have to to a degree, LeBron, Schroeder, AD, KCP, Gasol, with guys like they've got off the bench, and you bring Montrezl Harrell off the bench, and he's kind of that secondary dude when AD's off the floor, where LeBron's just killing on pick and roll with Montrezl Harrell, who's one of the better rolling forwards in the league. I just don't see a team beating this team, barring injury. I think the Lakers are significantly better than they were last year. I think they're significantly better than the Clippers are.
Listen, I think that they're definitely better, but I will point out, as much as we can question the role guys, even after they proved time and again that they would come up and play in the biggest moments at a high level, that's what they did. Caruso, Rajon Rondo, these guys never hurt them. So I don't know if we can exist in an alternate reality where we look at that and say, that's a vulnerability, when it never actually was a real vulnerability. But I do think that they're improved.
Yeah.
I don't want to dismiss the Gasol signing, because obviously playing a guy who can really space the floor and defend at a high level alongside AD is a big win. I do think, though, we've seen serious regression from him in this past season, and I think that you're aware of that. He is offensively, he's really an interesting guy to watch, because the playmaking is obviously still there, but sometimes he's too content to just sit behind the line and shoot threes. Sometimes it looks like he doesn't want to shoot the three at all. And so he's just really not much of a factor there. Now, alongside AD, he's probably going to be getting a lot of quality looks traded for him, and he can kill you in those situations. And defensively is still a plus, and I think that they got him an incredible value. So he makes them better. I don't know how much better he is effectively than what Dwight did for them this past season. Now, he can do more things for you, but I don't know how many things they need him to do. Dwight was perfect just in that crashing the boards and being a pest on defense and protecting the rim, all those things he did at a high level, many of which he probably does better than Marc Gasol. Then again, Gasol has other tools. So I agree. I think the Lakers are the best team, but I think the Clippers are also significantly improved from last year.
Yeah, I look at Mark and I see defensively what he's going to bring for them, because I thought they were going to take a step back defensively. I no longer think that. He is one of the best thinkers on that end of the floor in the league. He's at the back end of things. He's going to see everything for you. He's going to get your defense organized, and that's why the Raptors have partly dominated the defensive end of the floor for the last couple of years. It's Marc Gasol. Everybody in that organization will tell you that Marc Gasol is the reason the Raptors have been what they've been over the last two seasons. So I just see that being added to the Lakers. Despite his regression, I think if he can show up in the postseason, this is a better defensive team and a better offensive team. And I just think that they're a lot better than everybody else. But we're not going to hone in on that fact, because that makes it not fun. I do want to ask you now, moving on here, which of the teams that didn't make the playoffs this past year do you think got the best this offseason, had the best chance of moving from the lottery into the postseason?
Well, I think that just by the nature of the conference, I'm going to side with the Atlanta Hawks.
Okay.
And obviously, Gallinari was a huge signing there. I think that he is far from a perfect fit, but I do think their offense is at the point where it's probably going to be too overwhelming to miss the playoffs entirely in the Eastern Conference, which really is not a very high bar. So I think that we're going to see now, how does Trae Young coexist with other really high-level offensive players around him? It's not a primary ball handler, which is what I really want to see. I want to see, okay, when he has another volume guard alongside him, how do they coexist? That's why I was really hoping for a Van Vliet addition. But with what sounds like it's going to be Bogdanovich heading to Atlanta as well, and obviously with the acquisition of Gallinari, that's a lot of offensive firepower, more than really any eight seed out of the Eastern Conference has had in quite some time. They're going to be terrible defensively, though. Absolutely atrocious. I don't know how Gallinari and Collins can possibly coexist there. If you throw Capella in there as well, Danilo Gallinari is not a three in any lineup in the modern NBA. So there are going to be issues there, but I do think they got better and they're going to be fun.
I will say this, they did quietly sign Chris Dunn, who's one of the best defensive guards in the league. Correct me, was he first team all defense this year?
No, he was. I don't believe he was.
Okay. Still, one of the best defensive guards in the NBA. That goes without question. I think that's going to be good as just an offset to whenever Trey is out of the game, they can throw that defensive guard at you, or even if they need to play somebody next to Trey, to try and compensate a little bit. I think it's going to give them a valuable option there. Same thing with Rondo. I don't necessarily know how they fit. All I'll say, though, is that they seem to be acquiring a lot of redundancy in their wing positions. And I don't know how they play all these young guys and Gallinari, and they've got Okongwu and John like, it seems like there's log jams piling up all over the place. Could you think that maybe this Hawks team goes all in now and trades Cam Reddish and Herder and Hunter, some permutation of those guys, for another NBA star?
I don't really know if the market is there for them to go out and get somebody at this point. I hope that that's not the direction they're taking. I like that they're gunning to be a competitive team right now. I don't have a problem with that. At the same time, you don't want to do that to the detriment of the future of your organization. Am I in love with DeAndre Hunter or Cam Reddish? No, there is a part of me that will always like Cam Reddish more than I should, just because that dude moves like a hooper, man. He's so fluid, and you just think about what he could be. DeAndre Hunter played, you know, he played solid this entire year, and he started for basically the entire year, and Cam Reddish started for most of the year as well, so that's going to be an ego check for these guys to go from starting their rookie year to now being seventh and eighth men, essentially, in their sophomore campaigns, and I don't know how Onyeka fits into things either. Immediately, I do think long-term he's perfect for them, but Capella is obviously going to be getting the bulk of the minutes at the five, so they have a lot of guys who, you're right, it's sort of conflicting timelines here, but maybe, Peyton, that's not the worst thing in the world, just because we don't see it often. Yeah. Maybe there's nothing wrong when you have a young guy who's also equipped to try to win now, maybe, in Trae Young. He certainly produces like an all-star. We haven't necessarily seen him play basketball that is cohesive to winning yet, but you have that guy, you have massive amounts of cap, so you go out and say, okay, let's make this guy happy right now, let's win, let's make this a winning locker room, and let's also develop our three top eight picks from the past 2 years. That's interesting.
Fair enough. I think that you're right, they're the obvious choice, Atlanta, just because the Eastern Conference is weaker. There are a couple other teams I want to get to here. Let's talk about the Suns. They didn't stop with Chris Paul. They went out, they got Jay Crowder. They got a couple other important guys, brought back Dario Saric. What do you think of what they've done so far? Where do they stack up in the West for you?
Well, I think that they are the obvious choice, even more so than the Hawks. They honestly kind of just slipped my mind. I love their roster. I think they're going to be a top six team out West. I think that they have an incredible blend of depth, young talent, and obviously two of the most incredible stars in basketball, two of my favorite players to watch in basketball, in Chris Paul and Devin Booker, who I think have complementary skill sets in every way. And we'll see if DeAndre Ayton can explode this year. If he can't with Chris Paul as his point guard, then I think that's pretty telling about where his development is going as a player. But I love how they filled out this roster. Bringing back Javon Carter is not insignificant. Adding Etuan Moore on a $2.4 million contract is pretty good value. He's not a game-changing player, but they're making the right moves. And then the Crowder pickup, if he is able to sustain some consistent level of shooting, which he hasn't done for his entire career, he's been as spotty as they come. But when he's shooting well, man, that is an incredibly valuable player. And that is a guy who is worth a lot more than $10 million a year. Of course, it will even out. But I think the Suns are in for great things. I think they're going to be a 50-win team this season. Wow. They're going to be one of the most potent offenses in the league, in my opinion. If you look at their offensive rating numbers, just when Rubio and Booker were on the floor together, they had a over 116 offensive rating. That is on par with the greatest offenses of all time. So that shows you what Devin Booker can do with, at the very least, a competent point guard alongside him. Insert a guy with all of Rubio's playmaking, defense, and three times the scoring ability. I think that we're in for something special and something very, very fun in Phoenix.
Well, the argument for them not making the playoffs, and I want to get your read on this, is Chris Paul misses 20 games, regresses kind of back towards the health status that you would expect from a 36-year-old point guard that struggled to stay healthy aside from last year for the better part of a decade. Do you think if that happens that the Suns still had the firepower, considering the moves that they made and the progression they showed in the bubble, to be a team that makes the playoffs in the West?
Absolutely. If he misses 20 games, then I think that basically all they have to do with how well they'll play with him on the floor is go 500, maybe a smidge above over that time, and I think they're totally capable of it. This team, we can say that it's illegitimate in some way. They just went 8-0 in the bubble, and they are maintaining that core and getting better in a lot of ways, because obviously they didn't have Kelly Oubre, who they don't have now, but they have obviously upgraded there. They didn't have Aaron Baines. So I think we're in for some real special stuff, particularly from Devin Booker, who I think is about to show a lot of people what he can do in a winning situation, because guess what? Nothing about the way he plays basketball is actually not cohesive to winning at this point. A couple years ago, you could make the argument. I still think it was a product of situation. So I'm all in on the Suns. I think they're going to be a lot of fun. I think they're pretty much a sure thing to make the playoffs.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple other teams that are kind of trying to reestablish themselves. Let's talk about the Warriors. Got Kelly Oubre, signed Brad Wanamaker, drafted James Wiseman, and now are seeking a $9 million trade exception because of the injury to Klay Thompson. The disability exception is what it's called because it happened not in season and everything going on. That would be big. That would allow them to move for another player. There aren't a lot of guys on the market now, but how do you feel about the Warriors right now? Do you think they're a playoff team with their current construction without Klay?
I think that they are right on the border. I'm going to lean just off the top of my head with no, probably. I think that they're certainly going to be one of the 16 best teams in basketball. Or not certainly, I shouldn't say, but I think it'll be very close to it at the very least. But that's not really what gets you in the playoffs when you're playing in the Western Conference. They're still not deep enough. That's just what it comes down to. They didn't do enough good things this offseason. Brad Wanamaker or a rookie Nico Mannion facilitating your second unit, I don't know if I feel great about that.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly hope that Mannion develops to the point where he can do that, because I would much prefer that. Wiseman has so far to go in his development as far as being an immediate winning player.
Sure.
I'm not particularly high on that. So the Oubre pickup I love. I think he gives you a lot of what Wiggins does, just better and a more sure thing, whereas you have to say, can Wiggins commit to playing defense? Can he knock down open threes? We know that Kelly Oubre can do that, and he brings you everything athletically and as far as creation off the dribble that Wiggins does. So I like that pickup a lot, and it's also great value because it's likely to be 2 second-round picks, which is a pretty good deal for them. So I like what the Warriors are doing. At the end of the day, the thing that has taken the ball out of their court is just horrendous luck with the really unfortunate injury of Klay Thompson. Maybe you could argue they could have better utilized their trade exception and whatnot, but I like the Oubre pickup, and
yeah,
they're going to be a little bit shallow on the wings. They're going to be shallow as far as bigs. We'll see what Kevon Looney is this year. We'll see maybe Alan Smilagic emerges and is an actual NBA player. They're going to have to bet on something like that happen, because otherwise they just don't have enough quality guys.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair what you just said. I really would like to see Steph have an incredible year and revitalize this team and put them back in the playoffs. I don't know if it's the best thing for them long term. The best thing for them long term, since they have their own pick, might to be in the lottery, and couple that with Minnesota's to move up in a loaded draft class next year. We'll see what happens. I do want to ask you quickly before we close things out here. I've got one or two more questions if we can fit them in. How do you feel about the Bucks now without Bogdanovich? The topography of their offseason has changed tremendously. How do you feel about where they sit right now?
They got better. I don't know if they got better by enough, because the Bogdanovich loss stings. There are a lot of teams you can put him on and say, does he really drive winning? Probably not. But for a team that needs a dynamic late-game shot maker, guy who can get himself a bucket in fourth quarters, Bogdan is one of the 30 best guys in the league at that, honestly. The dude can get his shot off at any moment and also brings you some nice secondary playmaking. So that hurts 100%. I do like the Holiday trade. They gave up an insane amount of value, but those picks mean nothing if Giannis Antetokounmpo leaves your franchise, so you have to do what you can to keep him. I like the pickup of DJ Augustine. I think that they did a good job filling out this roster. I like the Bryn Forbes pickup, but it's not insignificant that they lost George Hill, so it is a big deal to not have to play a non-shooter in big minutes like you had to do with Eric Bledsoe. At the same time, Holiday is not the guy you throw the ball to with 30 seconds left and say,
true,
okay, go win us this game. Chris Middleton is still that guy for them, and that is maybe enough. It wasn't enough this past season. There were more flaws than just that. So Milwaukee might be the favorite out of the East right now. I certainly still don't think they're in the title conversation. The two L.A. teams, to me, just like I thought they were for all of last year, are head and shoulders above the bunch, and Milwaukee got better. But again, I don't know if they got better by enough.
Okay, last question here. Can you explain to me why these bad teams that are going to be bad regardless try to make win-now moves like they have so far this offseason? Like, what is Charlotte doing? What is New Orleans doing? This is the one and only year where you are going to take no negative by tanking, because you don't lose out on ticket revenue, and there is an incredible draft class coming up. What the hell is going on?
Well, I don't know if we should lump New Orleans into that group, because I think there was a real world in which they could have competed for the playoffs if they went about this offseason the right way. But what they did is they acquired quote-unquote win-now players who are probably going to be to the detriment of their team as a whole, because they're spacing disasters. So I don't love what they're doing at all. As far as Charlotte, I think if they just see an opportunity with the eighth seed in the in the East because of how abysmal it was this past season, the least. And I think that they're trying to capitalize on that. Now, obviously, paying Gordon Hayward that much is absurd. At the same time, they do have cap to blow for right now. And I do think that he complements their style of basketball, and maybe there's a world in which everybody gets a lot better because their core is incredibly young. LaMelo is immediately a highly impactful player, and they do get the 8 seed. To answer your, I mean, really, though, I just appreciate them doing it because I think it's going to be fun. Mm. We're going to have a decent race out west, and I'm excited for that. So it doesn't make sense. It borders on incompetence, but teams trying to be competitive isn't the worst thing for the fan.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm sure Sam Presti does, too. That's Carson Brebber. You can find him on the Nerd Sesh podcast talking about basketball and football, among other things, with Logan Camden. Carson, thank you for coming on today, my friend. This has been Run It Up. We'll run it back tomorrow. Got a little bit better today. Bye-bye, everybody.